Recovering Queen, the Queen fan podcast where we talk about and play the songs we love with Jay, Matt, and Ian.
Welcome to Recovering Queen, the Queen podcast where we take a famous or not so famous Queen song, do a cover version of the Queen song, and then talk about what we've learned about the methods and the madness of the greatest band that there's ever been, Queen. My name's Ian, and with me, as ever, are Matt and Jay. Good evening, gentlemen.
Ah, hello.
Good evening, Ian.
Good evening. And it's my absolute delight to welcome our special guest, singer tonight, Emma Siegfried. Good evening, Emma.
Hi.
And Emma, would you like to tell us which track, famous or not so famous by Queen, we're talking about tonight?
So we're going to be talking about Somebody to Love. So it's going to be a big one.
It is a big one.
Is this the best track by Queen and therefore the best song of all time?
That is very debatable. I think it's up there with Bo Rat. Arguably better. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, let's make the case. Let's see.
Yeah. See. I'm just going to say it. It's better than Bo Rat. It's my favorite song of all time. So there's going to be no doubt about what the scores are going to be.
I don't think there's going to be any doubts either.
Could be quite a high scoring one, couldn't
this
it?
This is definitely a high scoring.
Let's not do the big reveal right now. So yeah, often is overshadowed, isn't it? The follow-up single from Bo Rap. But not really a follow-up. I think they're always slightly cagey about it. They say, no, we're definitely not redoing Bohemian Rhapsody. How could you? But it's kind of just a more congruent song, isn't it? It kind of makes more sense. It's more elegantly constructed.
But that is its genius. I mean, if you are Freddie Mercury and you're sitting there going, how the hell do I follow up Bohemian Rhapsody?
Big ask.
It is a big ask, isn't it? And then you deliver this. It's like, okay, fair enough. That's it. Yeah, you're not a one hit wonder. Not that anyone was suspecting that, but it's like, wow.
Yeah, what do you think of it like that, Matt? Do you think that's how he thought of it?
You must have done. If you were in a band and you had to do a follow up album for Night at the Opera, and everyone's looking at Freddie to be writing the big hits, aren't they? It's like there must have been some pressure, unless he's so cocksure of himself at this point. There is no pressure. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, I suppose you're only as good as your last release, aren't you?
Yeah. Their last release was as a single was You're My Best Friend. It's also a very pretty strong song, isn't it? So it's got to be better than that one.
And to follow it up in this style and to do such a tremendous job of kind of gospel. I mean, where did that come from? Because there's like, you know, very, very little of that type of religion. Obviously, first album, Queen, as I like to call it, you know, that's full of Jesus and loads of religious stuff, but not this type of kind of more black gospel stuff. So where does this come from?
Oh, they call it the Aretha Franklin tribute song, don't they? I think a lot of people see it as that. Sort of trying to replicate that sort of gospel choir.
And doing a good job, by my ears anyway. And, you know, from what I've read, everyone says that, yeah, this is kind of how a gospel choir might do it.
Well, do you remember when he was on that Mike Reed interview, Matt, in the end of the 80s, and he picked out his favourite track of all time, which was Natural Woman by Aretha Franklin. So... yeah, he was a massive admirer. He loved what she was doing. I really love the version at Milton Keynes. I know we're not quite onto the live stuff yet, but the reason why I'm bringing it up now is because it feels a bit more bluesy in his take on it, and he's bending the notes a bit more, and he's, I don't know, and with the sort of ad-libbing, it feels, I don't know, this for me is a perfect track, but it's quite constrained, and it's perfect in its constraint, I would say, on the album. But it's lovely to hear him really let loose with it and really have the space to sort of just really take it. Because it's what is it, about 5 minutes? 5 minutes?
It's almost exactly 5 minutes long. Yeah, it's a long song.
It's a long song, but it's a whole world in its own. You know, you can put it out to 7-9 minutes, and it sustains because it's just so wonderful to hear.
Is that the live version? Is the Milton Keynes one where he's shouting, are you ready, brothers and sisters,
yeah,
at the start?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's there, is it? Right?
Oh my
yeah,
God.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, there are so many good live versions of this song.
Montreal is the top one, 100%.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've discussed Montreal is possibly the best live gig of all time that's captured on film anyway. It's on,
there's Team Montreal and there's Team Milton Keynes, isn't there, for MK. The best show of all time.
MK.
Yeah, are you really an MK? I'm
only for this song. Only for this song.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah,
there's just an energy on this song that I just absolutely love.
You can tell he's just very, very proud of it. I mean, he definitely considers this a better song than Bohemian Rhapsody. And I mentioned ages ago on the podcast about this idea of maybe Queen aren't great songwriters. And I didn't quite know what I meant by songwriting at that point, but I've been trying to formulate what I mean by songwriting. And that is songs that would stand on their own as songs, like you could print them in a songbook and other people could perform them. Whereas Queen tend to write songs but are purely based around their performance. So like Bohemian Rhapsody is very much a performance piece where it requires Brian May and requires Roger Taylor, it requires Freddie to be singing on it and performing it and actually delivering it. And so it's written as a performance piece rather than a song. Whereas I think Somebody to Love is much more of a song where anyone could go and sing it and you go, oh, that's a great song. I've been trying to formulate this idea of what it is when I say like Paul Simon is a better songwriter than Freddie Mercury, but I prefer listening to Freddie Mercury because I prefer Queen to Simon and Garfunkel, but I understand that they're a better songwriters.
Yeah, I think that's right, Matt. It's also when there's no sort of superfluous stuff on there where it's very direct. There's like, it goes from A to B or wherever it's going, it goes exactly to there and it doesn't take any unnecessary detours. So it sort of has this perfected quality or this crafted quality about it that, you know, everything is in the right place. And it flows seamlessly from one idea to the next because it's doing quite a lot, this track, isn't it? I mean, the breakdown.
I was going to say, the breakdown bit, that's almost, I mean, dare I say it, a bit superfluous to requirements. Now I say that just in the context of this, so don't misunderstand me, please.
I'm going.
In theory, you could lose that bit and you'd still have a damn fine song. You know, the find me somebody to live. It's not utterly essential to. You understand the point I'm trying to make. I'm not sure if I'm making
I disagree. I think because it's a gospel song, you need the everyone dancing in the aisles type moment. Otherwise, it's not functioning as a gospel song.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I prefer it with that.
But you could
edit it out and it wouldn't make any difference. It's basically what I'm saying.
I don't know. I think it would cease to. I think it'd cease to be a gospel song. But it's clearly
it would still
Freddie,
be a great track if without. Yeah,
it would. Yeah.
I think you know Freddie and John are well known for liking this era of music as well. The Aretha Franklin, that era of music that both of them are properly into it. Because John Deacon plays an absolute blinder on this song. His bass playing is absolutely, it's superb. It's absolutely.
How good is Deacon on this track?
Yeah,
but then, you know, really none of them are any slouches, are they, on this?
Is this the peak Queen? Are we talking peak Queen right now on this track?
It's a toss-up between Doubt the Races and News of the World, isn't it, for peak Queen in terms of their playing?
I think this is pretty much as good as it gets.
Yeah,
popular music.
Freddie's great on piano. It's Freddie's finest piano playing. That the opening riff is still like my favorite piano riff. Like and hardly anyone plays it right. And it's beautiful piece of piano playing.
Matt, I got something useful off ChatGPT earlier on. You'll be pleased to know.
Here we go.
Well, it was actually talking about the introduction when I prompted it for a little bit more like lesser known facts. It started talking about the baroqueness and the barkness of the introduction on keyboards, which is something I've never really noticed before. But it is a bit sort of bark-esque, isn't it? That intro.
Yeah, and it's not very gospel. That's the weird thing about it is that there is. It's like Freddie's take on gospel, where it's kind of his processing of what gospel sounds like. And it kind of isn't. It's like, yeah, that the particularly that piano riff and yeah, like big heavy drums and guitar solos. It's like, that's not in gospel, but somehow it works, isn't it? It's just held together by some.
That's all the way through this song, isn't it? The other influences of Queen. I mean, most gospel songs don't have like a screaming guitar solo coming flying through. But yeah, it's their take on it, isn't it? And Emma, what did you make of it? What do you make of this track?
I would say it probably is my favourite of all time, definitely. Just above everything. There's just so much going on. I don't think anything similar has ever been replicated, in my opinion, anyway. But same with The Day That the Races and News of the World. I can't put one above the other. I don't know what it is, but just that era, I think it's just the best era of Queen, I think,
But you're so young. You're so young. When was the first time you were kind of exposed to those albums and to Somebody to Love and songs like that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember the first time I heard them, but the whole of my teenage years was spent obsessing over Queen. That was when it really hit. I knew about them a little bit before that. And then I used to listen to Planet Rock Radio a lot. And then obviously they get played a lot on there, and it just sort of went from there. So I've grown up with it, really.
Yeah, there is something really special about Somebody to Love. It sums Freddie up as well. There's something where it's like he's hit this kind of musical stride, but lyrically it's Freddie, isn't it? It sums him up. Like just
and they're perfectly,
perfectly
married, aren't they? The lyrics and the performance and the song are perfectly married, you know, to each
it's
other.
It's like his lyrical meme, isn't it? Searching.
Yeah.
You know, we see it in so many of his songs through his career, you know, it's like, it's almost quite sad, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, but it's also something that we all relate to, you know, it's that searching and wandering, you know, it made me think earlier on when I was listening to it for about the millionth time. It's almost like the most human thing. If I wanted to represent what it means to be human, it's almost something that you could put in the bag at least, or you could send on a, you know, a rocket ship and say, this is what it means to be human, in a way that I don't think AI is yet quite at that level. And it's something unquantifiable, but you know it deep in your bones or deep in your heart. You can feel it. And it's both terrifying, sort of upsetting, but wonderful and magical all at the same time. I mean, it's basically every human emotion rolled into a 5-minute song. I mean, it's incredible. Mm. That's how I think of it.
Yeah, and it's there isn't a poor bit in it either, is there? And the Roger's drum sound and Roger's.
Well, Roger's greatest fill in the middle of the guitar solo, isn't it?
Oh, God, yeah.
Bing, bong.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just. Oh, God, yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant. Do you know what? That I spent a lot of time on this version getting that fill in right and trying to get the tom sound right. I think this is the closest I've got to getting Roger's tom sound as well. I'm pretty pleased with how it's turned out, but it's so elegant, isn't it?
The triplety feel to it, and then the rotor tom at the back end of it.
But what's so good about Roger's fills is that in your mind you can see him playing them, the way he kind of almost sits back on the drum stool to kind of do them.
Yeah,
and that's that brilliant documentary with Bob Harris on the News of the World. Where they're sort of the News of the World, and they're playing bits of this, and you go, oh my God, that is so good. And that's what I mean, peak Queen, where they're all playing together.
Mm.
And this is peak Queen because they're all working together, and they're clearly all getting on, and they're all totally in this groove, aren't they? Where everyone is with each other and totally playing with each other. And that's like this song and News of the World, and it starts to go away from that by the time you get to Jazz. But
I thought it was a very good guitar sound as well.
I was quite pleased with the guitar sound. I've probably overdone it a little bit, overdone the Brian May guitar sound. But it's that's actually thanks to our last week's guest. He did send me his modeler of
the, oh, you used Thomas's
Thomas Brunkard's tonics
Queen
model.
Thing again. Yeah. Oh, excellent. Mm. Yeah, good. Well, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because that's the guitar solo. It's much like Don't Stop Me Now, what we'll do in a future episode, where that's all Brian gets to do, isn't it? Isn't it just the solo and there's no other guitar?
No, there's
the
a bit
thing?
Of, there's a rhythm guitar where it gets to jing, 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 jing.
Is there?
Yeah, just before the solo. That's it.
Oh,
but yeah, and obviously lots and lots of backing vocals. Oh, and the other thing I did, look at this, is my sixpence.
That, the actual Brian May sixpence.
Yeah, that Adam Payne's
for the benefit
friend.
Of the listeners, Matthew is now holding up the sixpence to the camera on.
Yeah, Adam Payne's friend found it at Rockfield Studios during the during these sessions. So it's proper. I've gone totally down the thing. The only thing I don't have is a red special, but, you know, just have to stick with...
Plenty more episodes for you to get.
If anyone wants to send me a red special, you can.
Emma, I asked you before we started recording, rather sillily, about the singing of the song and if it was difficult or not, because... I mean, we all had a quick look at it and it was like, yeah, that's very difficult to sing. How was it for you?
It was really interesting, actually. When I was a bit younger, I used to sing that song everywhere, all the time, all sorts of gigs. I hadn't sang it for quite a while anyway, but I'd never sang it in a lower key. So it was quite interesting to try something different, really.
Right. So because we'd lowered it because we were going to have a crack at it. And so it's funny hearing you say a lower key because it's so high. I mean, it's so ridiculous. But you sound like you're just breezing through it. Would that be fair to say?
I don't know. I don't know about breezing, but it was definitely it was okay. Yeah, it was within my range. I enjoyed singing it. So you have to think about it a lot. I think with Queen songs, you have to really think about sort of the phrasing and the tone and the placement maybe a lot more than you would.
I noticed your phrasing was very, very good on it. I found when I had a little go early doors before realizing that it was way, way beyond me. And that was one of the things I found incredibly difficult, the phrasing. That's not normal phrasing, is it, in a song?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's almost muscle memory just from singing it so many times and hearing it so many times.
Yeah, like I said to you, I think there's something really nice about the low register of your voice and the fact that you've managed to maintain that intensity going lower than you normally would. I think you've done it you've done yourself proud. And I'll put this into context is the fact that you're a student at the college that I teach at and you're on the songwriting, doing the songwriting degree and not the not one of the vocalists. And none of the vocalists got near you, Emma. So you did well.
You've done a cracking job on it. I really, really enjoyed listening to it, and I'm sure our listeners will. What else? What else? Did you know this didn't get to number one?
Yeah, really? it's held off by Chicago.
Because
isn't it held off by Chicago?
No,
Shawaddy Waddy.
Oh God!
Yeah. Under the Moon of Love. Well, come
Which,
on.
Which, in its defence, is a good song.
You were a bit very quick to say that, Ian.
No, weirdly, I have to say, when I was like about 5 or 6, I did actually really like Shawaddy Waddy. I liked their jackets and stuff.
Yeah. Like,
but that is
Matt is wearing a jacket. If you
yeah,
can see
I am
him
wearing
now,
my Shawaddy Waddy jacket. But yeah, now it's kind of associated. It's a little bit thuggish, isn't it? Somehow the Shawaddy Waddy look. It's like you'd expect someone at like a men's club to be hanging out with a fag in his mouth with a bulldog or something like that. But it's like...
I don't think there's
many
people that have the Shawaddy Waddy look these days, Matt. I don't know where you're hanging out.
Well, you haven't been up north, Jay. That's
we can issue an apology there. We'll leave a little gap, exactly. and we'll move on.
I'll leave that to my northern cousins and everything. No, Matt doesn't mean anything. but number two, could you believe it? I mean, there is a whole history of the charts keeping wonderful tracks off... off the number one spot by something not quite so good. Vienna by Ultravox, a very famous one, which was kept off the top spot by?
Shaking Stevens?
Joe Dolce, Shut Up Your Face.
Now we're talking.
So that's, you know, I think that's equally as tragic.
Yeah. But yeah. It did go to number one, though, in one country.
What country was that?
European country.
Holland?
Yes, Matthew.
Yes.
Well done.
Wow. That was a good...
that
jacket you're wearing is really helping you.
Yeah,
that's done his research.
No, they get to number one a lot in Holland. I think there's a solid Queen fan base, the Dutch.
Mm.
But I think it's also a quirk of their charting system. But who knows? Now, what about the George Michael version?
Oh, wow. I love that version.
Wow.
Really do.
Yeah. We were there. Check
even
this
after
out,
standing in Wembley Stadium for about 7 hours beforehand, when he came on, it was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, all three of us were there. Yeah, so watching that, it was one of those moments where we all looked at each other and it's like, yeah, this is the show. It was almost like the mini Live Aid moment where he's stealing the show.
And he
really did, didn't he, George Michael? It's like, oh my God, maybe Queen have found a new lead singer. But of course, George Michael probably was bigger than Queen at that point. So that was never going to happen.
There's the documentary about it, isn't there? All the bit behind the scenes. And apparently George Michael was just there for every rehearsal, just desperately trying to, you know, and practice and made sure that it was, a world-beating performance.
Sorry, I don't think anyone could have done it like that. I really don't. And obviously, I'm not sure which documentary it was, but there is one where they talk about his partner at the time. They just found out that he had AIDS as well. So I think that might have been another emotional aspect of it.
There's so many elements of George Michael that mirror Freddie Mercury as well. There's something really, really similar in their story and outlook. You know, they're both immigrants, aren't they? They're both gay. They're both like unbelievably talented musicians. They're both in bands, and it's just like, yeah, they're kind of kindred spirits. And George Michael definitely felt like that. He definitely sort of idolized Freddie Mercury.
Yeah,
but
yeah, I heard that thing as well.
Always on the search for. Well, I think one of his love of George Michael's life died very young, didn't he? Which kind of knocked George Michael for six for the rest of his days. From what I understand, rather tragically.
No, I think it was that, wasn't it? It was very recent, like that he just lost him. So, yeah, I mean, I can only agree with all of that. It's rare, isn't it, where you get a performance by somebody that is amazing, and then someone else does another amazing performance of it. I mean, how often does that happen?
It's pretty much completely unheard of. It's like, I saw one weirdly the other day of what's that Use Me song by...
Van Dross?
No, if you put a duck in a microwave, he's Bill Withers. Bill Withers, Use Me. classic funk track. But there's a version of it that's just as good that was released in the same year by Estee Phillips or someone like that. But it's so good, and you go, oh yeah, which version's better? And you can't actually tell. But they're both like classic versions of the same song. Mm. But yeah, George Michael. I mean, that says everything about George Michael, that he's able to kind of beat Freddie in. Well, not beat Freddie, but be up there with Freddie in Freddie's absolute sweet spot. This is Freddie's sweet spot, isn't it? I mean, it's like he couldn't. I guess the only thing he's not doing is playing piano.
I was going to say, he didn't. He didn't play piano, so Freddie's always got the slight edge, hasn't he?
Yeah, although apparently George Freddie Michael wasn't Michael did write "Careless Whisper."
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Which is also up there.
It's not a competition.
It is, well, our scoring would suggest otherwise.
Although Freddie's definitely better.
So, Emma, you've kind of given it away in terms of this is your favourite ever. What other Queen songs are sort of up there in this kind of echelon for you?
It's just so difficult. I mean, if you're looking, there's not very many that I don't like. I'll put it that way. But if you're looking at the ones perhaps you don't hear so much, My Melancholy Blues is one that I really love. I really love the BBC Sessions version of it. I don't know if you've seen that. I think it's on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just so many gems that you don't hear about unless you listen through all of the albums.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's
the podcast.
Yeah, we have gone through 126 of them at this point.
Well, no, we do talk about that, don't we? We've talked about that quite a few times where, the, you know, like a track like My Melancholy Blues or Take My Breath Away or, you know. It kind of feels like not enough people know about these tracks. Yeah. And somehow they're such deep cuts that people don't get to them. Like you say, you have to, there seems to me that there's enough of them to make one hell of a great album all on its own, you know.
How on fire is Freddie on this album though? With You Take My Breath Away is on this. You go, I mean, that really is, that scored insanely highly on this program and rightly so. I think it did. Just unbelievably good. Millionaire's Waltz, another 10 out of 10. Yeah. That we gave it. Somebody's Love Us, obviously. Let's see where that's going to end up. Good old fashioned Lover Boy.
Oh, Jesus.
I mean, incredibly, Good Old Fashioned Lover Boy might be the weakest of the Freddie songs on this album, which is insane. Yeah. You know, that's like, he's basically, he's absolutely untouchable on Doubt the Races. He's only doing magnificent songs. Mm. And John Deacon's only turning up and playing the best bass lines on every single one of them as well. Like those two are, what am I talking about? They're all unbelievable on every single track on Doubt the Races. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
They had some good sweatbands around this period as well, which don't forget, which we haven't really spoken about much.
Oh, is this the sweatband period?
Yeah. Roger's got his sweatbands. Freddie's got his sweatbands. I think we should bring them back in honour.
It's a good point because actually Queen would still been in their silky, Xandra Rhodes, is it, costumes that they were wearing. And they'd been in that phase for quite some time, including Bohemian Rhapsody, including You're My Best Friend. But by the time they get this video for Somebody to Love, Freddie's wearing an Hawaiian shirt. They're all a bit more casual. They're letting the music talk for itself rather than dressing up, rather than being rock stars, rather than still being in this fantasy scene. So that dress thing is actually, you're onto something there, Jay. They are dressing more like, hey, it's the music.
Dressing
it's
down.
The music where, yeah, Freddie can turn up to the studio with in a Hawaiian shirt and a pair of shades and some jeans, knock out Somebody to Love.
Was that more 80s, Matt, wow. Hawaiian shirts? Was that 80s?
No, it's this. Watch that BBC performance, the video for Somebody to Love. Is it BBC? Well, whoever shot the video for Somebody to Love and Freddie's in a Hawaiian shirt and they're all pretty cash.
Yeah.
Then they were out of that though, don't they? When you look at the first few albums, there's so many deep cuts on there as well that no one talks about. Ogre Battle.
Mm. Yeah.
We talked about on the first episode, didn't we? That, you know, we started off with As It Began, White Queen. And it's like, well, to Queen fans, this is a colossus of a track, but it doesn't get out in the outside world. Luckily, Somebody to Love, that one has permeated the national psyche, hasn't it?
Yeah. Emma, as a young person, what do you make of the sort of latter catalogue or the 80s catalogue?
Yeah, well, I would say I prefer the 70s, but I don't hate the 80s. Some people won't listen to it at all, but I don't know. I think maybe there's more songs that aren't perhaps as listenable, but when you go into late 80s and, you know, you're looking at The Miracle and then even into the 90s when you've got songs like Innuendo, there's still some brilliant songs as you get into that later part. Just depends on preferences because it starts almost prog, really, I'd say, at the beginning.
You're talking about the beginning of the 70s, presumably.
Start their career.
Yeah.
Well, Innuendo, of course, ends prog as
ends
well.
Prog as well.
I mean, Show Must Go On, Innuendo, they feel both pretty proggy to me.
Yeah.
And they both reference their early material as well in a kind of nod to it, as it really does feel like they're bookending their career at that time. Like, and I guess Freddie is working on that level, isn't he? But it's interesting that I think you might be right. Your generation probably love the 70s stuff and not so much the 80s stuff, but the people in between us, because us three are in our 50s, you're not even 20 yet, but I think the people in between, the sort of 30 to, you know, that maybe the 25 to 45 bracket, they grew up with 80s Queen and are a lot more and love it a lot more, because we've had lots of guests now and they tend to be in their 30s and they they kind of love that 80s Queen because that's the Queen that they grew up with. And it's really interesting.
Mm. And yeah, the era that you were buying the album down the shop or your parents had brought it back and you were listening to it for the first time is massively influential, isn't it?
It is, although my introduction was in the early 80s, really, I think.
Yeah, but it's with things like Live Killers and...
And Granny Sins.
By the time the works had come out, we'd probably listen to most Queen albums at that point, I think.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think because I remember the works coming out and being really excited about seeing Radio Gaga on Top of the Pops. Like, this is, oh my God, it's a new Queen song, and just like being so excited about it and talking about it at school with Phil and Chris Clement and stuff like that.
Shout out to Phil and Chris.
Just changing the subject slightly, the gospel element, I'm thinking when they revisited gospel, and I can only think of one track in the very latter days of Queen that they revisited or Freddie revisited gospel.
I'd also include Soul Brother, which is very gospely, B-side of Under Pressure.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's very gospel. But yeah, more famously, All God's People.
Yeah,
as well, All God's People,
pretty much. I mean, Soul Brothers just got that kind of gospel feel rather than the full kind of...
I suspect All God's People is going to have a very different scoring outcome to...
I wonder.
But we may not have to wait too long to find out.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of things I noticed because I helped out on the backing vocals. The end bit, the "Find Me Somebody to Love," some really interesting harmonies in there. Some adjacent ones that really give it an unusual quality. Kind of reminded me of those harmonies we talked at great length on in "Where Are the Champions," where the notes aren't the ones you're expecting when you start singing them. There's quite a few throughout, and in the build-up section as well, there's a few in there that are a little bit odd, but yeah, I loved those harmonies at the end where you've got to force yourself to. I think it was a note above the actual melody, and you've got to sing those, and it's like a headspace you've got to get into. It's so difficult.
It took me ages tidying all that up as well, and it's because the precision that Freddie has done on those. This is back to the doing Bohemian Rhapsody as well. The precision that Freddie has in timing and pitch, because this is before Melodyne and everything else, the precision he's got there is absolutely ridiculous. It's unbelievable amount of skill that he's got in that area. And I think it is mostly Freddie that's doing those vocals, although I think there probably is quite a bit of them... three of them together standing there and doing each part one at a time. Yeah. But it's obviously being led by Freddie because it's they're not the sort of notes that you would hit naturally.
No,
a lot of them.
They're not. And I found them really difficult to get.
You've
got to start singing them without hearing it almost and then bring in the music at the last moment and hit the notes.
They're not just triads either. There's lots of five, six chord notes. So there's chords over chords all over the place. So you've got a lot of harmonic complexity in those backing vocals.
Yeah,
and the production of it as well. The one thing I haven't achieved on this version is that build up with the floor toms. The way that it builds up and that somebody, somebody, somebody. And it's like, that is just unreal. How they've done that, I just don't know. Cause I've never heard anyone come close to replicating that kind of like it building and really being this really powerful choir where it feels.
Matt, while you're talking about that, here's a question. How do you write a song like that? Do you write it on a piano and then drop that all out? Do you take all that out? How do you get the scaffolding, if for want of a better phrase, to actually create something that's just, you know, vocal?
Well, I think the backing track's jammed out. I think this is one of those ones where Freddie, John and Brian have gone in and done the backing track. So Freddie's written the piano part. Because the piano part is quite congruent, as in it feels like you're just going through the chords and it's there. And there's the odd riff in there. He puts the odd riff in like a guitarist would. And then, but it's mostly he's playing the chords throughout And then it's like, yeah, then we've got this section that's, you're just going to play drums, and then Roger will play a drum beat, and then they'll start singing over it, I think. And then it's going to come out into this section. So I think it's jammed out a little bit. So
does
I think
the tempo vary throughout?
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
So that's a dead giveaway then, that it will be a
jam.
A performance.
So this is all starting to make sense to me now, why Freddie's sort of bizarre phrasings, the way he's, because he's just coming out with them, isn't he? In the moment, these are ad libs that he's decided to keep because they sound great. Because you'd never come up, I'm sure you'd never come up with that if you were sitting at your desk crafting a song. So that makes sense.
No, yeah, well, that's back to this songwriting thing, is the fact that songwriters, I don't think tend to do that sort of thing, whereas singers do. And it's interesting, Aretha Franklin, of course, didn't write all those big hits. It's people like Carole King and people like that are writing those. Weirdly, Freddie did a Carole King cover as one of his very first singles.
Larry Lyrics.
Yeah. But so in some ways he's more influenced by Carole King's writing than anything else. But Aretha Franklin is bringing that kind of improvisational energy to the music. So that's the difference, because there's a Carole King version where it's quite straight, those Aretha Franklin versions. And a lot of people prefer them, actually. They're really amazing. Carole King is a great singer in her own right. But the Aretha Franklin versions have got more panache and more kind of exuberance to it. And that's what Freddie is also unbelievably good at. For someone who's self-taught, you know, it's someone who's started off in Queen. You listen to Queen, and he's a good singer, but not a great singer. By the time he gets to Queen 2, it's unbelievable how quickly he's moved from good to world class.
Do you think he ever had lessons? That's a funny thing to say, I know.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? I think it's really down to I think he's got a really good ear, and it's down to listening to Aretha Franklin and just doing it all the time. When you read about him, he's sort of, when he's at Ealing School of Art, and he's just messing around all the time and singing. And Freddie was getting little tips from people as well, like, how do I do this? How do I do that? Just like always meeting people. So he would fit David Bowie's boots when he had that market stall. He ended up working for a bloke who sold boots in the market, and David Bowie would go by, and Freddie would go, "Oh, let me sell you some boots." And but how do you do this? How do you do that? And and he did it with Chris Squire and David Bowie knew Freddie as their boot fitter. And then when suddenly he's like their support act, it's like, it's you, like that.
Brilliant. It's like,
so yeah, you know.
I suspect Freddie would be slightly reluctant to have lessons, as he was slightly reluctant to do anything about his teeth, which he was quite self-conscious of, what we know, but he was worried that he would lose something about the timbre or the something of his voice. So I suspect lessons, probably not so, you know, he might chat to David Bowie about how you survive on tour or something vocally, but I don't think he'd be going to anyone that was going to encourage him to do something fundamentally different.
No. It's funny, isn't it? Yeah, because I think we've spoken before how when he was doing the Montserrat Caballé stuff, and we're going slightly off topic, but just very quickly, he was actually in awe of her and didn't think that he was fit to be in the same space, because she was such a great singer, and I'm just a rock and roll singer. You know, it's quite odd, isn't it? There's sort of that. Can you not see? Could you not realize?
But all that, you know, all you know, the love for Freddie is since his death. You know, we didn't kind of know at the time just how good he was. We all knew he was good and he was an amazing frontman, but the real true genius of Freddie is really kind of a recent thing.
Yeah, we're about to talk. One of the tracks this season is a classic for that, where it's grown and grown and grown in stature. I think this song has grown in stature as well, but Freddie definitely as an icon has grown in stature. And there's something peculiar, isn't there, about the British psyche, is that when someone gets a little bit too good, we tend to go off the boil a little bit on them. And then like 10 years later, once they've died, we can then be really nice about them. It's what happens with Phil Collins and Sting. Like, they're kind of like, oh, Phil Collins, Sting, like that. They're kind of semi-hated in the UK. But as soon as they're dead, they'll be like, oh my God, they'll be at the same level as Prince and Michael Jackson. Absolutely. But it's like, but until then, they've just got to deal with the public hatred.
Unless you last as long as like Elton John, where then you become a national treasure somehow, because he's kind of reached that level. But again, he'll get a boost when he sadly passes as well.
Yeah,
so.
Pops his.
Yeah,
clogs.
You're right. You're right there. We don't like people to get too above themselves in the UK, do we?
But this
in the psyche.
No, but this track has it's been featured in films, and there's been lots of other versions. I can't think off the top of my head, but I think Disney and Hollywood have used this film, used the track in like a few different situations over the years. It's certainly a track that doesn't go away. And I haven't
heard it being used in an appalling commercial yet. So maybe they are kind of keeping it as one of the crown jewels that they will never advertise floor cleaner with it. That's
a question though, isn't it, Ian? What if you were going to advertise something with somebody to love, what would it be?
Tinder. Or Grindr, actually, I suppose would be more appropriate.
That'd be more appropriate, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Anyway, we've talked now for the exact same length of the album Day at the Races.
Right.
So we should probably...
Well, if any track deserves it,
this one. So Emma, just to fill you in, we score it out of 10. And it's out of 10, from 1 to 10. So the worst Queen song would get 1, and the best Queen song would get 10, or lots of Queen songs can get 10. But it's based on the Queen catalogue, not other people's catalogue, or else it would most of the songs would be in the 8 to 10 scale. What we're going to do is we'll score it. So, Ian, what is your score?
For Somebody to Love, off of Day at the Races, it's a 10 from me.
Jay?
Yeah, I mean you can't even talk about this track really, can you? It's unearthly. No, I mean, it's a 10.
It's a 10. It's definitely a 10 from me. I can't think of any song that I would give a 10 more than this.
Before you give your score, if you want to give us a few more pointers about which other Queen songs you might also give 10, just to give us and the listeners a bit of context about your Queen fanness.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, it's got to be a 10. I mean, can't not be a 10, first of all. Yeah. There's no way. I think it's the best song ever created. What ones are going to be up there? That's the thing. That's a great question. There's so many good ones. I know I mentioned Innuendo earlier, and I think that is quite underrated. I mean, obviously, it's got Steve Howe on it as well. I'm pretty sure that's the only Queen song, aside from David Bowie, obviously, that has someone else featuring on it.
Oh, don't get started on that one. No, there's quite a few.
I like a lot of the older songs. There's just so many. I don't know. There's so many that you could put a 10, in my opinion. A lot of the ones I spoke about earlier, I absolutely love. I really do. I don't know what it is about it. It's just got to be up there. Again, you mentioned You Take My Breath Away, that I absolutely love, because it's only Freddie and the piano and harmonies. Mm. And there's not a lot of songs that they've done that are just that. It's just, there's just such a range. It really is. It's incredible. I can't think of any other band that has made that many good songs in all different genres.
I mean, that's it for me. It's the going from Bohemian Rhapsody to this just seems absurd, yet it's so obviously the same band.
Yeah, but I've just realised something. So it's Freddie's favourite song. I know it's Matt's favourite song. I'm pretty sure it's Ian's favourite song. Would I be right, Ian?
Well, that's got some stiff competition on this very album, hasn't it? As being Queen's greatest song of all time.
I was going to say, you think Long Away is better.
Oh, Long Away.
Well, hang on. You always used to say this was your favourite song, because I used to say this was my favourite song, and you went, yeah, me too. So that's what you said?
Yeah, might be. Well,
he was just trying to impress you, Jay.
The proof will come out in the scoring.
Was it your round?
All I'm saying is, how often does that happen? It's like a full moon, isn't it? An eclipse, rather. Full moon happens quite regularly. Yeah. You know, this moment in time, it's how good this track is.
I have to say, Jay, I have to thank both you and Ian and Emma, because this is a proper joint effort as well. Jay's bass playing, I have to say, Jay, you've absolutely pulled a blinder on that one. your Rickenbacker sounds real. It actually made me think maybe John used a Rickenbacker on it because
wow,
it's got...
You do it on a Rickenbacker. Wow, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've and only got one guitar.
But I think yeah, I kind of it kind of sounds like that. It's got that kind of twang to it. It's definitely better than if I'd done it on the Precision.
Oh.
Ian, thank God you were there doing the backing vocals for all the high bits. but actually, yeah, ours blended sounded really well. It would have been good if Jay had managed to do the whole lot as well. I think we could have padded it out even further. But yeah, Emma, well done for doing. You did yourself proud on that vocal version.
Thanks.
Absolutely,
yeah, really good. Lovely version, Emma. Well done.
Here is our version of Somebody to Love.
Anybody find me somebody to every day of my life, I work till I ache my bones. At the end
of the day,
I take home my hard earned pay. All my own. I get down on my knees and I start to pray till the tears run down from my eyes. Lord, somebody,
yeah,
can anybody find me?
Somebody to love.